You. Well, this paper is actually a joint effort between Jason Hine and me, but since I am the presenter, I get my name in the program, and Jason is simply ignored. So I'm, you know. And Kathy is passing out some manuscripts of the scripture that I'll be referring to. So my topic is the voice from the whirlwind and natural evil. And looking at the biblical book of Job. The book of Job recounts a man described to be, as we read in the very first verse, blameless, a man of complete integrity. He feared God and stayed away from evil. And as the narrative develops, God allows Satan to test Job, telling Satan in verse 12, do whatever you want with everything he possesses. Calamity then strikes Job. A fire from heaven burns up Job's sheep. A powerful wind sweeps in from the south and collapses Job's house and kills his children. And later, Job suffers boils from head to foot. Job's attitude progresses. First, a calm acceptance of his losses. But later, he insists that he has been dealt with unfairly, a conclusion that he reaches after receiving unhelpful and inappropriate counsel from his friends. Job screams at God, demands a hearing, and asks for justice. And then a surprise. God responds to Job. God, as the voice in the whirlwind, opens his response by making one and only one accusation against Job. God says Job is ignorant and asks in Job 38, verse 2, who is this that questions my wisdom with such ignorant words? In the speeches that follow in chapters 38 to 41, God teaches Job aspects of creation, mainly through rhetorical questions. By doing so, God points out to Job the divine strategy in planning, creating, and overseeing the operation of the world. God points out properties of the physical world, along with examples of animals and birds. From this, God expects Job to deduce the principles by which God designed, created, and maintains the world, leaving the core principles unspoken. God demonstrates his patience toward Job by explaining creation to him through these examples. So Job 38 to 39 contains 17 stanzas. The first 10 referring to physical features of the world, followed by 7 stanzas giving short descriptions of 9 animals and birds. Chapters 40 and 41 contain 2 longer descriptions of the behemoth and the leviathan. Now, our plan is to examine the content of the speeches to gain an understanding of natural evil, the type of evil that Job suffered. We will seek to understand how God's goodness and power can exist alongside a world of suffering caused by natural processes such as earthquakes, floods, storms of all kind, devastating illnesses, birth defects, nature red in tooth, and the physical death of living things throughout creation, including deaths of humans. Finally, we'll suggest some implications for ministry as we followers of Jesus are called to respond to victims of natural evil. So first of all, we'll take a look at the biblical text. The first stanza, chapter 38, verses 4 through 7, describes the structure of the world. We read that God has exhibited high skill and competence in planning, constructing, and continuing to manage and nurture his creation in a consistent way. God created everything with a purpose, but many of his purposes do not directly relate to humans. There is no indication of any unplanned chaos in creation, no surprises for God, and no indication in the speeches of anything that needs fixing up. God knows his creation very well, for he has planned and measured it and has a purpose for each aspect. An example of God's management is related to the seas in chapter 38, verses 8 to 11. The sea can be dangerous. Water can be destructive. But the text indicates that God has set boundaries that the sea cannot normally cross, resulting in the establishment of dry land. In verses 12 through 15, the voice declares that creation is renewed by God as each new day is created. This signifies the continuation of the creation process in a consistent way. Because of this faithful repetition, the study of creation, which is science, is a worthwhile endeavor. Science is a legitimate, appropriate, and valuable enterprise, since scientists are in effect looking for principles by which creation operates, principles that God instituted and upholds. Accordingly, we should be thankful for each scientific discovery, for it gives us further information on just how God created in the past and creates and upholds now. Now, the voice chides Job for not knowing enough. And apparently, Job does not know enough about creation, for creation is what the entire speech is all about. So not only is science a legitimate enterprise, but the implication is that we ignore creation and hence science at our peril. Our understanding of creation is the key to understanding God's plan for creation, and this is a prerequisite for understanding natural evil. In the next two stanzas, the voice points out the existence of the underworld and the realms of light and darkness, verses 16 to 18 and 19 through 21. These verses imply that there is more to creation than the eye can see. What we can directly experience represents only a very small fraction of what can and does occur in the universe. Again, the voice implies that our limited understanding of creation is related to our struggle to understand natural evil. The next four stanzas, chapter 38, verses 25 through 27, 28 through 30, 31 through 33, and 34 through 38, depict in various ways that God has created an ecosystem that nourishes the earth and its inhabitants with all forms of water, rain, dew, frost, ice, and snow. God has provided means for spreading these forms of water across the world, many times in a gentle way, sometimes in torrents, sometimes accompanied by lightning, sometimes accompanied by destruction, floods, tornadoes, hurricanes, tsunamis, tidal waves, blizzards, storms of all kind. The destructive effects of water introduces another aspect of creation. The suffering of creation, the kind of suffering that results from the way creation was planned and continues to be carried out, even at the present time. This natural evil, sometimes called physical evil, is a part of creation. This particular form of natural evil results from the destructive distribution of water over the earth. An example close to home is a tornado that devastated Joplin, Missouri, a little over a year ago. Cutting the channel for torrents of rain in verse 25 seems to imply a kind of lawful randomness in the normal processes by which creation delivers water to the earth. And we've heard a little bit about randomness today and last night. If God directs each rainfall, then each tornado, tsunami, and flood is a result of God's direct action. But what if the distribution of rainfall across the surface of the earth is a result of processes inherent in creation? And what if there is an aspect of randomness to those processes that ensures that over time, a given area of land tends to receive the rainfall it needs to thrive? Could it be that the randomness which results in conditions for thriving will also sometimes result in conditions for suffering? Is this consistent with what we know about God, or think we know about God? Calvin College mathematician James Bradley, in the most recent issue of Perspectives, defends the viewpoint that scientific randomness and the historic Christian understanding of God's nature are compatible. Paul Ewart, Oxford University physicist, agrees. Next, starting in verse 39 of chapter 38, God turns to the world of birds and animals. Nine examples are discussed in the remainder of Job 38 and 39. First, the voice points to the lion and the raven in 38 verses 39 to 41. Lions and ravens are born to hunt prey, to get food for their young, and as such are examples of blood and suffering in the world of living things. There is an order to creation. This includes a food chain that involves suffering, blood, and death in the hierarchy of animals and birds. Life feeds on life, and new life depends on the death of old life. If there were no death of creaturely life, there would be no new life. Stated more positively, the process of creation includes provisions for renewal and new life. The next stanzas give examples of diversity, another hallmark of creation. Here we find that God has created a number of animals and birds that are useless to humans. The voice points these out to Job. The mountain goat, shy, elusive, useless to humans. The onager, or wild donkey, wild, never domesticated, temperamentally unsuitable, independent, avoids humans. And there's actually a special tone of affection here. The aurochs, or wild ox, a wild beast, fearsome and unmanageable, useless to humans. The ostrich, stupid, can't fly, fears no predator because of its speed. Why does the voice point these out? Is God showing Job an example of his sense of humor? Or is it that God values diversity? And then we come to a magnificent animal, the wild horse. And finally, to finish the first speech, the voice points out the hawk and the eagle or the vulture. More examples of animals that feed on blood and dead stuff. Now, in the second speech, the voice affectionately describes in some detail two additional untamable animals of no use to humans. The behemoth, probably a hippopotamus, in chapter 40, verses 15 through 24. This animal represents more diversity. It is gentle, satisfied, at peace, and doesn't use its strength to lord over others. Does this animal represent God's freedom? Freedom to refuse principles of utility, even of aesthetics? In contrast to the behemoth, the leviathan, perhaps a crocodile, is presented in chapter 41. This is an animal that is very different from normal human experience. Struggle with it is dangerous and fruitless. The leviathan expects to be feared and respected, and yet this is another part of God's creation and is presented to Job in God's longest discourse in these speeches. So what are we to make of these descriptions of animals and birds? We find there is diversity in the animal creation. Consider the 11 kinds of living creatures that are discussed. Most are useless to humans. Some fearsome, Some rather stupid. Some are magnificent. Most cannot be trained. None can be tamed. Some do very little except to eat, sleep, and procreate. Some eat other animals. Some scavenge. Some drink other animals' blood. But none are criticized for what they are. They are discussed in a straightforward manner, and for some, God shows special delight in his descriptions. So, the question Jason and I have asked is, what can we learn about natural evil from these two speeches of God to Job? So we have some tentative suggestions. Number one, there is no hint of anything wrong with the universe or with our world. Creation, including the animals and birds, seems to have come out as planned. God has created everything with a purpose, and this includes purposes that have nothing to do with humans. And there is no hint of nature having fallen into sin. Number two, creaturely death is a planned and a necessary aspect of creation. Creaturely death is a vital part of the food chain for living creatures. In the absence of creaturely death, humans would not be living on our earth at this time. The earth would have already been overwhelmed by all kinds of living things, for example, insects. Creaturely death has existed for as long as life has existed on our earth. Number three, unfortunate things can happen to people, animals, and the environment because of the way the universe is, a universe that was planned and is upheld faithfully and wisely by God. Four, there are two consequences of natural evil. One is that creation suffers. The other is that creation exists. Our world would not have developed in the way it has, and our existence as humans would not have come about if the universe, its laws, and its physical parameters had been anything other than what they actually are. This fine-tuning, this is known in science as fine-tuning and leads to the anthropic principle. The universe was fine-tuned at its creation for the emergence of earthly life, including human beings, many billions of years after the Big Bang. Fifth, there is lawful randomness in nature. The occurrence of disease, mutations in the living world, and natural disasters are all associated with a certain amount of randomness. This randomness is lawful. You might even extend this and say either randomness or unpredictability. But whatever it is, it's lawful because the universe operates under laws of physics, chemistry, and biology. And hence, the weather, genetics, disease are at least partially understood in terms of these laws. But there's also this random or unpredictable aspect, resulting in events that appear hit and miss only because of our inability to predict their exact occurrences. Again, the Joplin earthquake is an example. Joplin was hit and destroyed. Nearby towns were not. And the nearby towns and farming region received nourishment from that same tornado that destroyed Joplin. The randomness is a part of God's plan for his creation and is evidence for a certain openness in some aspects of physical process. And can perhaps be understood in terms of in physics, chaos theory, and certain formulations of quantum theory. The universe and our Earth, including the bio world, can only undergo healthy development and adaptation to its changing environments if there is this characteristic of openness that is exhibited in terms of lawful randomness. Number six, nature has been given freedom to explore possibilities. Developing this previous point just a bit more, our universe and Earth are in some ways open systems and not to be understood as strictly under deterministic principles. Some have said that God has given free will to humans to do good or evil, and that nature has also been given a certain dimension of freedom. In addition to lawful randomness, the possibility of miracles is also consistent with a universe that does not operate under completely deterministic principles. Seven, nature demonstrates God's faithfulness. The existence of natural evil is actually a sign of God's faithfulness. Natural evil is the necessary accompaniment of a structured world. The absence of widespread miracles is also a sign of God's faithfulness. It's probably better for the health of the universe that not all prayers for healing are answered positively. For one requirement for new life is the death of the now living. And yet God is actively involved in nature and actively upholds all creation and its laws through the sun. God knows how nature operates, and a lawful universe is to be preferred. Number eight, God's knowledge. God knows the universe and its life intimately. God knows all the details. Nothing about the universe is a surprise to him, and in the sense that his overall purpose for the universe is threatened. In contrast, Job's knowledge was defective and incomplete. And the last point we suggest is that we live in a dangerous world. As is pointed out in the Chronicles of Narnia, Aslan is not a tame lion. He's a loving lion, but he's not tame. There is no evidence that the terrifying features of creation, including the Leviathan, arise from the sinfulness of humankind. Like Job, we simply don't know enough about the world, even today, to declare what is inherently good or bad in nature's processes, apart from our personal experiences of them. So how are we to respond as followers of Jesus? First, I think we need to ponder these chapters in Job to work out for ourselves the implied principles behind the examples the voice put forth in the speeches. Second, we as the Christian community need to respond appropriately to natural evil when it occurs. From these principles, we learn the truth of Ecclesiastes 3, that there is a time for every purpose under heaven, and this includes thriving and suffering. So then the Christian community must respond in a caring, merciful, and helpful way to those who suffer the effects of natural evil. And third, we can take courage and grow in our trust of the God who knows and is faithful to his creation. In the final analysis, we can stand on the promise of Romans 8:28, quoting from the New Living. And we know that God causes everything to work together for the good of those who love God and are called according to his purpose. Thank you.